And welcome into the Wednesday edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. It is Wednesday, so anything goes. Today we had something planned, the intersection of sports and politics and what should, if any, their roles be, even if there should be a role for politics in sports at all. But my guest has fallen ill, so unfortunately we'll have to reschedule for another Wednesday down the road. Hope he's doing better. And hope he enjoys today's podcast. But we will circle back around with him coming up in the coming weeks. If you do have any thoughts on the matter, please, as always, feel free to hit us up on Twitter at Doug Russell Pod. You can also email the show at DougRussellPod@gmail.com or on Facebook. Just search for the Doug Russell Podcast. We're also on Instagram now, username Doug Russell Pod. We do have a great show for you, nevertheless. One of my all-time favorite conversations from a show that still runs Sunday mornings on WTMJ, but the constraints of radio dictate that an hour-long show after news and commercials is actually 36 minutes, not an hour, 34 minutes after all of the intros and resets. Nobody's fault. That's just how it is. That's the packaging of an hour-long radio program. Sometimes, though, because of time constraints, great stuff gets left on the cutting room floor. I had one of those great conversations about 3 years ago with the great John McLaughlin, Mr. Buck, the guy who was a player, then a broadcaster, now an ambassador for the franchise, along with being the most public face of the Mac Fund, an organization that raises money for research that treats childhood cancer. Now, when the Mac Fund started, if you don't know, if you haven't heard this story, the survival rate, this was in the mid-1970s, the survival rate for kids diagnosed with blood cancers, leukemia and the like, was 20%. Today, not quite 50 years later, the survival rate is over 80%, in large part because of the research that's been funded by the Mac Fund. I've been fortunate enough, they continue to ask me, and I'm always blessed to be able to say yes, but they've invited me to their annual golf outing every June for the last, 15 years or so out at Tuckaway. One of the events I most look forward to every year. I talked about radio's restrictions a minute ago. No such restrictions here. This is the raw audio. This is unedited. This is uninterrupted with someone that I have such incredible respect for. We go into John's childhood. We go into his college days, those early days with the Bucks, winning a championship with the Bucks in 1971, how he found faith. It's such a huge part of his life as well. And I think some of that may have gotten cut from the original radio broadcast. But again, this is an unedited, unfiltered. This is just the whole thing. This is an hour long conversation that John and I had. We went into what the Mac Fund means to him personally. We went into how he would like to be remembered. If this sounds like a relaxed conversation that he and I had, that's the idea, because we were sitting in John's basement rec room at his house as we were recording this. So I think that hopefully comes through as you're listening to it. But my conversation about 3 years ago with Mr. Buck himself, John McLaughlin. Hope you enjoy. You've been here since the beginning. I know you're from Indiana. Do you consider yourself a Milwaukeean? Do you consider yourself someone still from Indiana?
Well, my wife and I consider ourselves lucky. We feel like we're from two states. But we've lived here twice as long as we lived in Indiana, because we left Indiana right out of college and went to the Cincinnati Royals, then to San Diego, then to Milwaukee. So we are certainly Wisconsinites. All of our kids and grandkids are cheeseheads. They were all born here. We've been here, as you said, coming up 50 years. So we are certainly Wisconsinites. We feel our Hoosier roots. But when the University of Wisconsin and Indiana play, the colors are similar. And I only watch them when they play basketball, because Indiana never has a chance in football. So we're Wisconsinites.
Fair enough. Tell me about growing up in Franklin, Indiana. What kind of town was it back in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, if you've seen the movie Hoosiers, and many of you have, and if you haven't, you should. It's one of the top three sports movies ever. And you don't have to like people from Indiana or basketball to enjoy the movie. It's based on a true story. And I tell people that my background is very much like the movie. However, I was from a larger town than Hickory, which is in the movie. By the way, that is a true story. It was in 1954, I think, that movie premise occurred. And the real town was Milan. But I'm from Franklin, Indiana. People, when I moved here, thought I was from Franklin, Wisconsin. It's about 20 miles south of Indianapolis. When you go to Florida, you drive almost through it. And but it was a town, I don't know, about maybe 8 or 9,000 people then, a little larger today, a beautiful town with, you know, a courthouse and the square and all of that. And when I grew up, I was born in 1943, so I really remember the 50s and the late 50s. Basketball in Indiana was king. It was food, water, life, air, politics. Basketball was everything. And so the stories you've heard about people from Indiana and Hoosiers, it's true. In 4 years playing varsity basketball, I never played in a gym at home or on the road that wasn't sold out. And some of them were pretty good-sized gyms. My wife's from a school that had a gym of about 5,000 people it would seat. The largest gym in the world is Newcastle, Indiana, and it can seat almost 10,000 people. It's where the Indiana Hall of Fame is. Growing up there as a basketball player from the moment I can remember, I was a basketball player. So growing up in a small town in Indiana was utopia. It was heaven on earth. But I didn't know it. I didn't know any different. That's what it was. But it ruled. But yet I had coaches and people, even though from the starting in about the sixth and seventh grade, it was obvious I was good and going to be good. I had coaches that made sure I didn't think I was that good, and and they kept you in line, and it was a different world. You know, you still were very subservient to your coach and the teachers and yes sir and things like that. But growing up there was a great environment for me.
Do you remember the first time you ever picked up a basketball?
I do. Well, not in my backyard, where I had a dirt court and a hoop, and eventually we hung lights. I started with a hoop on my garage, and I remember being out there around in the fourth and fifth grade. But my first experience was the sixth grade when we had a practice. And I remember all the guys, we went to practice, and we pulled on our gym shorts to practice, but we left our underwear on. And in those days, we all wore boxer underwear. So my underwear hung out below my trunks. Pretty cool dude, man. And we were all like that.
Time.
No one told us about a jock strap. I'm not sure we needed them yet. And I remember sitting on the floor and the coach, Harold Hamlin, Mr. Hamlin, who taught civics in high school, was our coach. Disciplinarian. I loved him. He said, okay, who knows where the forward plays? And I raised my hand and I had no idea. I didn't know what a forward or a guard or anything was. So that was my first organized year in the sixth grade. But seventh and eighth grade team was when I started to realize, and everybody else, that I had talent.
And you and I were talking before we turned the tape on about your most memorable game that you ever played. In your office today, you still have a piece of the floor from a game, not that you played at Indiana University, not a game that you played in the NBA, not the All-Star game that you played in 1969, not in the 1971 NBA Finals, but from high school.
Right. It's interesting, Doug, to watch writers and sports people over the years ask me a question about your greatest game, and I say, well, let me explain. And they're, you know, their mouth opens. It's like, high school? I mean, you played in the NBA All-Star game and two finals and championships, and those were great, no question. But just one single game that had an impact on me was in 1961, my senior year in high school. And we played on a neutral court because it would accommodate more people, around 4,000 people. And we played a Catholic high school team from Indianapolis called Cathedral. And they were ranked second in the state at that time. And they had a 6'10 center who went on to Notre Dame, and I played against him then at Notre Dame and when I was at Indiana. And I was a center in high school. That's all I played, center. And this game was sold out, standing room only, neutral court, number 14 in the state versus number 2 in the state, and two of the best players in the state in Walt Somm and John McLaughlin. And it was triple overtime, two sudden deaths, which they must have only had that for a period of time during that period.
Sudden death. Think about that.
So after the first overtime, if you score a free throw or a field goal, the game's over. Second overtime, no one scored. Third overtime, second sudden death. And the coach at the timeout before the third overtime, he said, John, we're going to have you play guard. It's the only time I played guard ever in 4 years in high school. One play, final game my senior year. And so what he did, he's had the other guard, who was a natural guard, give me the ball. And, of course, the irony of this is I played guard at Indiana mostly, a lot of other positions too, and then guard in the NBA. So it was a vision of things to come, I guess. And the other guard gave me the ball. This big center came out on me, and the top of the circle is 20 feet. So I was about 4 feet behind it when I got the ball. So that's about 24 feet out front from the basket. And I just started moving and dribbling and taking him. And I pulled up somewhere above the circle, so around 21 or 22 feet, and let it go. And that moment froze in my mind. And I've told the story many times in speeches. And I could just see it, but I couldn't hear the fans. I blacked, you know, my ears just went off. And I can see the ball going up, and it hit the rim, and it's like a movie. It went around the rim about four times, and the type of shooter I was, I didn't hit the rim a lot. I hit the net a lot.
Okay.
And we weren't even talking about how much money I could make today.
Right.
But, and then it went in, and it won the game, and it was my 30th point. So I scored 30 in the
winning. Which is a lot in high school.
A lot. No three-point line, and I was a center.
Right.
So I scored 30. And I averaged about 23.5 or something that year. And and the fans came down, you know, on the floor, everybody carried me off. And it's interesting, my mom and dad, they made every game I ever played in anywhere. And then in Indiana, they would make all the home games, which is about a 100-mile drive round trip. And they made half of the Big Ten games. And they would go with Tom and Dick Van Arsdale, who are my best buddies. I played with in Indiana, who were pro players. Played 12 years in the NBA. Our parents would go to all these games together. My mother went outside at the end of the second overtime for a smoke. The door locked. She couldn't get back in, and she missed the final.
Oh, no.
And my basket. And I'll tell you, to the day we lost her, man, she was upset about it. But it was a great moment, and it was so dramatic. I mean, I've had some winning baskets in the NBA and in college, but not with three overtimes and two sudden deaths.
Yeah, that's amazing. And like when you say it, like it came out of a movie, I think that it's like a scene right out of Hoosiers.
Absolutely.
Where you make the shot and then the soundtrack goes from real time to and you see one guy in the stands pumping his fist.
That was it. That was it. It was beautiful. And back then, you know, there were no class system in Indiana. And so a little town could go beat a big town like in the movie Hoosiers. And that's what happened. It was a great place to be. And, you know, it's interesting. I look back on my life, and when I was 5 years old, my father, who was a milkman and then later a taxi cab driver, struggling financially, almost took a job in Florida, which would have moved me to Florida. And I've often thought, had that happened, what would have happened to me as a basketball player? Because I wouldn't have had the surroundings that I had with, you know, 20 and 30 guys in my backyard in the summer at night playing on a dirt court, one basket. That wouldn't have happened. And I don't tell this story often, but I guess it's long enough now that no one can get in trouble. When I was a sophomore in high school, my dad came to me and said, John, he said, I've had job offers from two other cities in our conference. I won't name the cities. If we'll move there to bring you to play in high school, in their high school. So that was my first experience with under the table offer. And he said, you know, and again, my dad didn't have great jobs. And he said, but it's your call. And I said, let's stay here in Franklin. And we did. But I've often thought about that when I went through college recruiting. And then later my daughter was highly recruited for track going through it. And even in my era, some of the things that came forward. And I thought about my high school. It happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that's growing up in Indiana.
And as an Indiana kid, when Branch McCracken comes and says, I want you to play for me at Indiana University, is that the dream of every kid growing up in Indiana?
It was then. I did look at Purdue, no question. I'll tell you the story. I was a freshman on the varsity, and there was a guy 2 years in front of me that was All-State and a great player. His name was Steve Van Antwerp. He was a forward, 6'4", thin, about 180. And Branch came to see him in our little gym in Franklin. I was a freshman. He was a junior. He came to see him. And, of course, when Branch came into the gym, it went around the entire town for a week. You know, Branch McCracken was a man of about 6'5", white hair, about 230, a powerful, imposing-looking, impressive man. And everybody knew who Branch McCracken was. And so it went around the town, and he made the comment to some people there and some writers that he said, well, I'm not interested in Van Antwerp, but I'm coming back to see that freshman, meaning me. He came back as a junior, and he came back as a senior, and he decided he wanted me. I was recruited by, I don't know, somewhere between 80 and 100 schools. There were coaches in my house all the time from my junior year to my senior year. Duke was the first coach from Duke. His name was Vic Bubas, who I think later coached at Florida, University of Florida, and coached Rick Barry. He was the first one to come and see me in the offseason and watch me play. But McCracken, I think at the end of the day, I was never going anyplace but Indiana at that time.
Tell me about when you got there, became friends with the Van Arsdales, still friends to this day. You got married, I believe, when you were in college as well.
Right after, just as we graduated. Okay. And it's interesting, Tom and Dick grew up in Greenwood, which is only 10 miles from my hometown, but they went to a high school in Indianapolis called Manual because their dad taught there and their mother worked in the office there. So they sent them to Manual High School. They had like, I don't know, 500 and some in their class, and they were first and third academically in their class. They were Mr. Basketballs. They were great players. We knew each other. We played boys club baseball against each other in like the seventh and eighth grade. That was it. Never basketball. So we were kind of jealous of each other, never knew each other. And then we agreed to go to Indiana. And the summer before we went to IU after high school, we played on a summer league team together with three other players, Jimmy Rail, one of them from IU. They had these outdoor tournaments in Indiana. Seriously, there'd be 2,000 to 4,000 people these outdoor tournaments. So we played together in those, and that's when we became immediate friends and ended up pledging the same fraternity. And after our freshman year, lived in the same room in the fraternity for the remaining 3 years together. And it's interesting, the day we all got the call from each of our NBA teams that we were drafted and the GMs called us, we didn't know much about it or did we even want to play in the NBA. There were only 9 teams and only 10 players on a team. So could you even make it? And if you did, you know, there was no real future. Mm-hmm. I was offered $10,000 to coach and teach in a high school in Indiana, and Cincinnati Royals paid me $10,000 my first year. But we all three then decided to go and do it. And but they were close friends. Met my wife my junior year, and she was on her way to Ball State as a freshman. It took us about a year, but then we fell in love, and she transferred to Indiana. My senior year would be her sophomore year. And then we got married literally right after we graduated. And actually, I was taking some summer courses to finish up my degree. And so she was 20 and I was 22, and we got married. And I had to go to rookie camp in June in Cincinnati, and somehow I made it through that. They had drafted 7 guards and for one job. And they asked me to come back to the training camp in September. We got married in June. I go to training camp in September, not even knowing if I have a job. It's too late to get a job in teaching or coaching or in business. I don't know what we would have done if I hadn't made it. God was shining on us. I made it. And we moved to Cincinnati for our first year. So we had to rent furniture. We had no money, you know. You just didn't, and you didn't get big bonuses like you do today. it's quite a bit different than the NBA today.
Quite a bit different. I mean, you were a third round pick and you were the 24th overall selection.
You're good. You did your research.
I did a little, you look things up. Wikipedia is a wonderful thing nowadays.
It is wonderful. And by the way, I have the draft list in my office from that year. If you look at that draft, some great players, mm-hmm. a bunch of all-stars. It was a great draft year. And I was 24, third round, which with 30 teams would be a first round
sure.
today. And I'm proud of that. Not a lot of guys did that well after my pick, only about one or two, I think. And but if you look at the draft year, some of those guys went on and played, like myself, 11, 13 years, and many of them were all-stars. It was a good draft year.
How hard was that early on in your career, your first year in Cincinnati? You and Pam had just gotten married. 50 years later, still together, of course.
Right,
so
right.
Congratulations on the half-century mark. Not many make it nowadays to that.
True.
So my folks did that last year. They got to their 50th.
That's cool.
So, I know how cool that can be. I know how cool that is.
It is.
But how hard was that early on in your career, moving to, I mean, Cincinnati wasn't necessarily far from where you grew
up. Just 2 hours, yeah.
A couple of hours.
Yeah.
But again, I mean.
Which my parents loved. They could come to the game. So,
sure.
Yeah.
I suppose it could have been a couple of years later you're in San Diego.
Yep.
But how hard was that early on when you're just kind of trying to feel your way through the first couple of years of your NBA mm-hmm. career?
You know, Doug, it's interesting. It was great pressure. I mean, just to make it, great pressure. We had no money. I was right out of college. Didn't have a job if I didn't make this team. Even when I made it, we had to rent furniture. We couldn't go buy it. I don't want to be one of those people say, oh, you know, I walk to school in the snow barefoot. But that's how it was then. You know, there was no fast food. You ate in every night. It was a different world. I felt great pressure. But if I went through it today, at my age today, it would have overwhelmed me with pressure. You look back and go, wow, how do we handle that? Well, you were young and dumb. I guess that's true. And just to make the team was something, and then to stay on the team, and then expansion started. And we can talk about that. I went to two expansion teams, and that's a war zone. That's hand-to-hand combat mm-hmm. to make a job. And we didn't have 10 and 20 and 30 million in the bank like guys today. We had nothing in the bank. So you played, man. You played hurt. You played. I think for six straight years in the NBA, I played 79 or more games. You played unless you were so sick or hurt you couldn't move. Today, it's not quite like that. But looking back, I feel more pressure than I did at the time. But it was quite a bit of difficulty, no question.
And you get to Cincinnati, and you've got some great teammates. Oscar Robertson, who would later you would team up with again in Milwaukee.
Right.
Jerry Lucas, Wayne Embry, Len Chapel, Flynn Robinson, who you would play with a little bit later on. And then in San Diego, Pat Riley, one of your teammates as well. John Block, who would come and play for the Bucks,
who had
later.
A great year that year in San Diego. And Don Kogis.
And Don Kogis.
A Milwaukeean.
From
West Allis, but
yeah.
A Milwaukeean, a Wisconsinite. Kogis and Block had great years that year. I think they were both all-stars, and one of them was in San Diego. Now, that was my third year. See, what happened to me, I get through my rookie year. I'm into my second year at Cincinnati. We knew expansion was coming. I was told by the Royals they would protect me because in February, I got a – well, back up. It was during Vietnam. Vietnam got hot and heavy. My aunt, who was on my draft board in Franklin, said – to my parents, John's going to get drafted into the Army. So I told the Royals that. They got me into a reserve unit. I got into an Army reserve unit there, and thank God, I appreciate that extremely. And they started calling up reserve units and guys. It was a scary time. You lost control of your life if you were in the Army because they were drafting you and you were going over. I got in a reserve unit, and my second year in Cincinnati, I received a letter from the government or from the Army Secretary of Defense office, however they did it then. I got it on February 10th, and February 16th, I had to be at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for my basic training. Doug, that was the scariest time of my life. It's the moment of my life I knew I had no control over my life. I had to go, and I could have been sent over, and I could have been killed. and it happened to a lot of men. And so my wife packed up, went home and lived with her parents in Indianapolis, and I went to basic training. I got through all that, didn't get my units called up for 6 years I was in the Army, but I had, you know, I had to go to meetings and summer camps and things for 6 years. So I served in that regard. And when I'm in the Army in Fort Leonard, Missouri, I call Pam on a payphone that you had to, no cell phones in, ladies and gentlemen. You had to stand in line to call home and talk to your wife. She said, John, I've just read in the paper that we've been expanded and picked up by the San Diego Rockets. Well, my coach in Cincinnati, Jack McMahon, went to San Diego as the coach and general manager. So he picked me. So it was really an honor that he picked me. So I call him on a phone from Fort Leonard phone booth and say, Mac, I know you got me. He says, yeah. He says, now, when you get out of the Army, I got out on June 16th. You go home. I want you and Pam coming out here right away. And you're making $13,000 now from the Royals. I'll pay you $18,000. I said, thank you. And that's how you negotiated in those days.
Thank you.
There were no attorneys. There were no,
right.
Thank you. They told you what they would pay you. So we drive out there and spend the year in San Diego on that team. Great experience. But at the end of that season, I asked McMahon to put me up in expansion. Milwaukee and Phoenix, they were coming in. And the reason I asked, who wants to go from San Diego to Milwaukee as far as weather and all that? And I didn't know Milwaukee. I only knew the University of Wisconsin. I played there, of course, against UW. I asked to be put up because Jack McMahon, the coach, who went from Cincinnati to San Diego and took me, he was never happy with the guards. And every night at a game, it'd be different guards. He was never happy. And the reason is he just coached Oscar Robertson for 10 years.
That'll do it.
And I realized, I'm not Oscar Robertson, and neither are these other guys. I need to get out of here. And I knew from a career standpoint, I'm not telling you I was that bright at that time in my life. I'm 24, I think. But they put me up, and Milwaukee picked me, and the NBA gates opened because I came here and was an all-star and averaged about 20 a game because Larry Costello played to me that year with Wayne Embry setting screens and the team we had. And even after Flynn Robinson came here and we had to share the ball, Wayne said, once Flynn came, I stopped screening for you guys and rolling. I would screen and just run down to the other end because you guys were going to shoot it. But the gates opened, and then we get Kareem, and then we get Oscar, and then we win a championship.
May 6th, 1968. So I don't know if you're going to celebrate that when May 6th next year comes around. That's the expansion draft date.
That was the date?
Yeah.
May 6th, 1968.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people need to know this. The first expansion player picked was Fred Hetzel from the San Francisco Warriors. He'd been Rookie of the Year that year. The Bucks picked him. I'm called the original Buck. And the real reason is I scored our first basket. I was our first all-star. And that's why I'm referred to as that. And it's a name and a tag that I carry with pride, with honor, and I'm very proud of.
And 50 years later, you're still there.
I'm still here in an industry that's almost ridiculous as a player or an announcer to stay with one team that long. I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm patting the owners, the GMs, the people that have been here. I've been through now four groups of owners. They've been wonderful. The first ownership group was very loyal to me under Wes Pavilon. He was a unique man that was very, very, he loved my father because they both grew up poor with nothing and he related. And then the Fitzgerald group, they were kind to me and good. Then Senator Cole, I love him and I'd do anything for him. And he was loyal and kind to me. And I'm still here. And this new group, thanks to Peter Fagan, our president, they're still loyal to me and they see a use for me. And the Milwaukee Bucks, after my family, they're my next family, not the current group of players it's the organization. It's the logo. It's the Milwaukee Bucks. That's my family, and it's family to my family because my kids grew up with it. My wife, it's in our blood.
I know you've gotten to take a look at the new training facility, and to compare and contrast where the Bucks were 50 years ago. Where did you guys even practice? You weren't at the Cousins Center yet, were you?
No. Oh, no. That would have been utopia compared to – we practiced at the old Concordia College over around 35th Street. People don't even know where it was. It's where Concordia now, which they have that beautiful – they had this little neighborhood college. We practiced in a gym that looks like it's right out of the movie Hoosiers. It's just this little old antiquated gym. The locker room was, looking back, disgusting. You know, it was just ugh. And that's where we practiced when we couldn't get into the arena, which was very often. So this new facility, which I went through yesterday with Peter Fagan and a friend of mine from the Mac Fund, Al Costigan, is spectacular on steroids.
I've only seen it in pictures. I haven't seen it. I haven't been inside it yet.
I can't even describe how wonderful it is. Now, people might say, well, no, all the other cities have similar, but Peter Fagan has done a spectacular job of putting it together, gleaning. He went to all the other places around the league and looked at what's best, what this, put it together. He's overseen that and the new building that's going across the street. He's been a phenomenon. And I know, you know, people right now are upset with ticket prices. I understand that. But what Peter Fagan has done with the backing of the new owners and Senator Cole's money, and Senator picked these owners, and he picked the people that would be best for Milwaukee, and he did a great job of that. He worked diligently at that. The senator did, and picked guys that hired the right man in Peter and got it done, man. What they've done is incredible. I can't even describe the training center to you, but it's spectacular. And actually, when I was down there yesterday, Jabari was working out and looks great, and he's got ways to go. And Giannis was there working out. They have two full courts in there side by side and everything that goes with it for taking care of these players.
Can't wait to see it.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely.
They even have a press room.
Really?
A room for the media to go in
and work,
and then you can come out at the right time and meet with the players or coaches. There's a media room for the media.
Okay. We're not sharing the tape room anymore?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. They've got their own rooms.
I'll look forward to
it. It's something.
I'll look forward to that, definitely. The high cotton days of the Milwaukee Bucks, when you played with Kareem and Oscar after your rookie year, when Kareem was drafted, and the Bucks won that coin flip. Did you realize how special it was to have those two Hall of Fame guys with this young fledgling franchise, and you know, it culminated with an NBA Finals victory?
Yes, we knew. Yes, immediately we knew. I'm talking about the players, and then the people in the organization. It was very small then, you know, the organization, and you had 12 players. You had two coaches and you had a trainer. That was it. And then Eddie, the announcer, traveled with us, and that was the entire traveling squad. Today it's like 57 people.
Right.
You know, we knew immediately. First of all, we're an expansion team, and we win 27 games, which had never been done before. So it was really a successful expansion team. We win a coin flip. So in sports, you got to be good. You got to do your work, coaches, GM, players, but then you got to be lucky. You got to stay healthy. You got to be lucky. We win a coin flip and get who? The greatest scorer in the history of the NBA, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Lou Alcindor at the time. We win a coin flip. That is luck. We then did the work. The work was then the next year after Kareem's rookie year, which is the third year, they go do their work and they make a trade because Bob Cousy was coaching in Cincinnati and wanted Oscar gone. They didn't get along. We get Oscar Robertson. They traded Flynn Robinson from Milwaukee and Charlie Polk, who had been our number one pick, to Cincinnati. We get Oscar. We knew then it's us. We're winning it. So that year at training camp, remember there was a guy with us from New York who wrote a book on us, and he was with us all year. And I can't recall his name. But from day one, he was with us, and he And I said to him, well, why do we get one book and the Knicks get 50? You know, oh, yeah, okay, well, it's New York and Milwaukee. We knew at training camp that year this was our year. We knew. We got those two great ones who, by the way, would be on anybody that knows anything, top 10 list of the two of the greatest ever on anybody's top 10 list are those two. And if you don't put them on it, you do not know what you're talking about, and so just go away. You know, because all these young sports people today, they don't know, they don't even think about Russell or Bill Pettit, mm-hmm. or, I mean, Bob Pettit or people like that. They don't go back that far. So anyway, we knew, and we knew we were headed for hopefully a ring.
And you got the ring. By the way, you wear your ring more than anybody else that I know that has won a championship.
Yeah, ring. I do. People probably think, is that ego? No, it really isn't. I don't wear it probably most of the summer. I wear it when I go to special events, like maybe something for the Mac Fund that's big, Bucks games, Bucks things, because, and this is why, people love to see it. They want to see it. It's the one thing that everybody's interested in. I wear it for the people. I really do. Otherwise, it's not that big like they are today. Today, they're too big to wear. But it's special. You can't buy it. You got to win it. Mm.
And as someone who will never have one himself, exactly. Every time I see you wear it, I'm like, oh, that's the hell.
How cool.
How cool is that?
And that's why I wear it, because people at Bucks games will stop me all the time to look at the ring. And that's why I do it. And I'm glad that I can. I think Greg Smith wears his, and he lives out in Portland. He was a starter on that team. Bobby, who has Dandridge, who has, I think, three, he doesn't wear it. Oscar and Kareem don't wear them. But they also don't wear jewelry, really, to speak of. And I just talked to Oscar a week ago. I call him every now and then. And Kareem was in town the night of the draft for something for the Bucks. And then he was out in the draft room, and he and I had a chance to sit and talk for about half an hour, which is – it's really a pleasure for me to get to always spend some time with those two guys. And Bobby Dandridge, he and I call each other often. So there's some closeness there. And I think – these guys will get a situation this year with the 50th. They're going to be bringing people back.
And they're playing a game at the arena again.
They are. And I'm thrilled about that. I want to make sure I'm in town for that game.
Right.
And I'm going to be there.
Yeah. Try to keep me that, you know, my childhood is going to games at the old Mecca.
So, and of course it was half the size of the Bradley Center. Almost people come up to me all the time and talk about how they enjoyed that because they get closer to the players and closer to the floor. And we were more accessible. Today there's security, there's everything. It's a different world. So it's I think the money and the hype has separated the players some from the fans today like it wasn't then. Same way with the Lombardi guys. Mm-hmm. You know, they were amongst the people because we all had to work in the off season and go do things where, you know, churches and sports nights, they would pay you something. That's how I met many of the Lombardi Packers. By going to those nights.
You played a couple more years after the 1971 championship, got back to the finals in 1974, and then a couple of years later, it was time to retire. I did a story recently, actually a series, on the end of professional athletes' careers and when they knew that it was over and how they knew that it was over. When did you know that it was over, and how hard of a transition was it for you in the mid-1970s when the money wasn't what it is today,
right?
That, you know, that paycheck would stop, but now it's time to do something else.
Right. I knew when the Bucks said, we want you to retire.
All right, that'll do it.
Okay, what was my 11th year? I'd had a real problem with tendonitis in my knee, and my back had been bad, but I was able to play. I played in a back brace for 5 years. I was prepared to play the 12th year, meaning I was in shape physically and mentally because I'd always stayed in shape. And Wayne Embry brought me in and said, John, we would like you to retire. We want your position for younger guys. I was 32 at the time. Today, that's not old. They can, you know, you can go longer. And then Jim Fitzgerald said, we want you in the front office. We want you to be the next general manager after Wayne Embry. And then it was decided, because I wanted to and Eddie wanted me to go on radio and TV with Eddie, which I did for a year, and then decided I don't want to be a general manager. There was no security and no money. I told Mr. Fitzgerald that, and he said, good, and whatever you want. I said, I want to find a business, and I want to continue to do radio and TV. And so about 3 years later, we started a business with Sal Bando and another gentleman who was a brilliant financing guy, George Shoneth. And we started Bando McLaughlin Capital Corporation, and I was able to do that in Bucks Radio and TV. But I wanted to play another year, but when you averaged about $40,000 a year, and that's, you know, it wasn't worth trying to go 1 year to another team when the Bucks offered me a position. So I decided to do that. In today's game, with the three-point line and 30 teams, I could have played as long as my body would have held up, because there's such a value on shooters today, and I was a good shooter. Therefore, I would have had jobs and a lot of money today compared to them. But it worked out great for me to be with the organization all this time.
Is that the biggest difference nowadays between the NBA of the mid-1970s and you know, the mid-20-teens? Is it just the money? Because, you know, they're still 5-on-5. It's still
right.
94 feet
right.
By 50. And then, you know, the baskets are still 10 feet. There's a three-point line now. But is it the money? Is that the biggest difference?
That's a good question, Doug. It's the largest obvious difference to the public and to the players. And let's draw a comparison. I averaged $40,000 a year. I made 80 my last year. And so if you average it out, I was at 40. Today, I would probably make $20 million a year easily when I see what some of these other guys are getting that couldn't shoot as good as me. I mean, I could stroke. I shot 52% for my career. Who does that from where I shot? And give me the three-point line. The money is a huge difference. And sure, the facilities and flying on commercial or private planes and the notoriety and the coverage and you know, social media, all that's a change. But the game itself, yeah, there's been some tweaking. They could put their hand on you when we played. They can't put their hand on you now. The three-point line, they've changed the game. Players are bigger by evolution and because of weight room, which we didn't have, and knowledge of how to weight train properly, and food. I mean, I was eating a steak for a pregame meal. That's ridiculous. Mm. We didn't know any different. So my first year in Milwaukee, I averaged 40 minutes a game. I started the season at 205 and I finished at 190. I lost 15 pounds. Well, I wasn't as strong a player at the end as I was at the beginning. Well, give me the proper food and give me weight training, I don't lose 15 pounds. How much better am I? Take that and apply it to Bill Russell, Will Chamberlain, Oscar Robertson, Jerry West. They were great then. So apply today's capabilities with everything, with masseuses and nutritionists and you know, all the weight training and all the stuff that they have now. Coaches to spend time with each guy. We were on our own all summer, you know, go come back in shape. So all of that would make players back then good, really good players today too. But the most obvious change with all those other things has been the economics.
As one chapter of your life closed as an active basketball player, another opened. That's how the Mac Fund began when you retired.
Right. You know, I look at my blessed life and say, I got to be an NBA player after growing up in Indiana as a basketball player. I got to be an announcer. I was in business 25 years with Bando McLaughlin Capital Corporation and another company. So I was a businessman and learned that. And then I got to start and help run and be involved in a 501c3 charity. I mean, what a blessing. I mean, to have all those careers and experience life that way. It's just being blessed. And being able to start the Mac Fund on my retirement night, and the Bucks bless it, and Eddie Doucette and I came together with the idea because his son Brett at 2.5 had been diagnosed with acute lymphocytic leukemia. We became very aware of childhood cancer. They're very dear friends, Eddie and Karen. And so Eddie said to me on a road trip, he said, it'd be nice to do something for cancer. And I said, man, I'd like to do that. So we went over and met the people at Children's Hospital, which was down on Wisconsin Avenue at the time. And long story short, we started the MAC Fund. And the Bucks said, whatever you want. They gave us a preseason game. Jim Fitzgerald did. Senator Cole blessed it. This group has blessed it. We still have the game. And it's a great story of the limelight of athletics focusing and shining on something really good and really great things happen. It's a good story. It's not a negative story about today and athletics or whatever. It's a good story. Without the Milwaukee Bucks, there's no MAC Fund because Eddie and I don't have the forum. And then we go on radio and TV and talk about it every night. And then people started calling me saying, Johnny Mac, we want to learn more. If you come to this or you come to that, we'll give you the money. I started going. And I would literally, Doug, I would leave places. They'd pass the hat. And I'd leave places with tens and 20s and dimes and nickels in all my pockets and take it back to the MAC Fund. The first year we raised $35,000. Now the MAC Fund's 40 years. It's 40 years. We raised $35,000. We just wrote some checks this past month to the entities that we give money to, which is Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, Medical College of Wisconsin, and Carbo Cancer Center, UW. It's all for research. We've just now written checks for $60 million that we've given for childhood cancer research. And the blessing is the cure rates, the five-year survival rates, there's still problems, but they've gone from 20 to over 80%. Those are lives. Those are moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas that it impacts. It's the most impactful, greatest thing that I've ever been involved with. And I have asked myself, how did I get from a dirt court in my backyard in Indiana to the NBA, to the Milwaukee Bucks, to this? I believe, that's what I believe, that it's God-driven and it was supposed to be for the MAC Fund. That's what I believe.
Faith is a big part of your life.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's especially since 1979 when I got on my knees in a hotel room in Portland, Oregon, and said, something's got to change. Please take over. And that's what happened.
What led up to that?
A number of things. It's, a friend of mine in Milwaukee who was a strong Christian who had pursued me to come to things, and I kept rejecting. A meeting with Sal Bando, who was still playing for the Brewers, who shared with me his testimony one night. The next day, I'm starting to really think about all this. And the next day, I'm at a Kohl's grocery store, and there was a drugstore by it across from Southridge, where I lived at the time. I came out. I had a little inexpensive, cheap sports car, and I parked it way out in the parking lot. Near no cars. And I'm walking out to it, and a voice behind me, a female voice, goes, excuse me, are you John McLaughlin? I turn around, it's a young woman with two bags of groceries coming out of the Kohl's grocery store. Now, we're 75 yards away from the store, no cars around mine, and she's right behind me. She says, are you a Christian? I've never been asked that in my life. And I went, she says, well, my husband and I are, and we're praying for you. I got in the car and drove off. I looked back, and I didn't see her. No cars around mine. I'm just telling people that's what happened. I'm not going to judge it. I'm telling you that's what happened. The next day, I get on a plane. I go to Denver to do a CBS game. And then I fly after the game to Portland to meet up with the Milwaukee Bucks. I check in. It's a very large hotel. And I check in. It's 2 in the morning. I never carry my own bags, but I was on a long road trip, so I had to have a bellman bring it up. I go up. I open the door. I walk in, and I hit power on my TV set. On comes Jack Van Amp of the Jack Van Amp Crusades, I think out of Cleveland, Ohio, talking about accepting Jesus as your Savior. I'm standing there with my mouth open. It's 2 in the morning. the Bellman Knox comes in. I guess he was 22 years old, in that range. He puts the bags down. He says, "Oh, excuse me, sir, what are you watching?" And I went, "I'm not sure." The guy talking about being saved. He says, "Are you a Christian?" Second time in my life in 2 days. I went, "I don't know." He said, "Well, I am." And he said, "It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me, and my entire family and friends are believers, and they've accepted Jesus." He says, "Can I pray for you?" And I went, "Oh, no, man, I'm, you know, Stood there for a moment, talked, and then I said, "Yeah, would you?" And he put his hand on me, prayed, and he left. I went on my knees. That was in 1979. Shortly after that, that year, Billy Graham Crusade came to Milwaukee at County Stadium, and I was asked to give my testimony at the Crusade, first time in my life, which I accepted, and I got to meet Billy Graham that night. I was in a room where you meet before, and they asked me to go put makeup on, pancake, because of the lights. I said, "I don't do pancake. I don't." They said, "No, everyone does, please." I go get in a barber's chair. 2 feet away from me is another barber's chair. And I'm in mine. Billy Graham walks in and sits down in that barber chair to get his pancake put on. And we talk for about 3 minutes. I mean, I'm like, you know, I thought like an angel had walked in and sat down next to me. And I was impressed with his humanity, his concern for the world and his family. And I had 3 minutes alone with Billy Graham to just talk. It was a great experience.
How does this impact your family life? Because at this point, you've got your son and your daughter, and you know, now you've got four granddaughters as well. So how does this journey then affect what you bring home?
That's an in-depth question, and that's a good one too, because I think you understand what we're talking about here. I came home and told my wife, and it scared her. It was like, is this going to change you dramatically? Are you going to go off the deep end somewhere? What does this mean? She was concerned, you know. I mean, we grew up in the area we grew up in. It was mostly Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians. And, you know, we believed, but we didn't follow. And Pam was the same way. So she was suspectful of what's this mean. And then she saw me starting to read the Bible every night for the first time in my life, suggesting we go to church so we get our young children at that time, you know, involved. And she's a mother. She went along with it. And it was about less than a year after that, she'd gone with me to a speech up in Ripon. And it was in December. And I spoke at something up there, and we were coming back, and she had told me that she had accepted as well. Just a few weeks before. And then we started going to church, and we started going to Elmbrook Church, and I got to know Stuart Briscoe and Jill Briscoe, and Pam did. And we both turned our lives, and we raised our children that way, which they're doing as well. So it's been a wonderful impact on our lives for the right decision, because eternity is longer than anything here. And I've thought about that as I speak about with the MAC Fund. I go out and I try to raise money, and I talk to groups and individuals, and we're talking about saving a child's life. And then one day it struck me, their salvation is even more important than that. Mm-hmm. Although I don't always bring that talk depending on where I am, but that's how I feel.
And then kind of to spin that into your work with the MAC Fund. And I think that there's a couple of different generations of John McLaughlin fans. There's the older John McLaughlin fans that remember you from basketball, and certainly the broadcasting as well. But I think that there's probably a number of younger fans that know you as the MAC Fund guy. Right. So how do you then use your faith as a guiding principle for turning a 20% survival rate into an 80-plus survival rate?
Good questions, Doug. I do get stopped a lot now, and people, the first thing they'll say, I know you, a MAC Fund, right? And when they do that, I go, wow, that's wonderful. The young kids, if it's either that or the millennials, or they'll say, a Bucks announcer, or aren't you on TV? The older people will go, hey, man, I watched you. It happened to me today twice. I watched you play. I loved it. You know, so it's all the gamut, Doug, and it's wonderful. It's a privilege. I can barely go out any day and not have people stop me and say something wherever I go. you know, if it's to eat lunch or whatever. That's really a privilege, you know, to have all those different things. Sometimes they'll even come up and say, hey, I was an investor in Bandon McLaughlin, and, you know, they bring up the business thing. I think, not to get preachy to people, but when you've made this commitment and you have Christ in your life and you're a believer, you know, all the movies and the sitcoms, they make fun of those people. They're the squares. That ain't the case at all. Just like the athletes back in the 50s, you know, when you see Grease and all those, they're the squares. The cool ones were the other ones. That ain't the case. It's not how it really was. The athletes were the cool ones and the people, you know. It's the same way with being a following, trying to walk everyday Christian. I've still sinned. I've made some major flaws along the line here. But you know what the yardstick is, and you know you try to raise up and admit that failure. John Kerry, executive director of the MAC Fund, is a strong Christian Catholic man. Most of the board, they have faith. Eddie and Karen, strong faith. We believe the MAC Fund is a Christian organization. But we don't preach it unless the opportunity is there to talk about it.
In terms of the Milwaukee Bucks nowadays, a couple of years ago when Senator Cole put the team up for sale, the fear, I think, among many sports fans, and I don't know how much of this permeated through the MAC Fund as well, but there was a real danger, at least in the minds of many, that, boy, if the right people don't buy this team, if a new arena doesn't get built, if the right decisions aren't made, this team could be somewhere else. How big of a concern of that was that to you?
Huge. Twice. First of all, when the Fitzgerald Group stepped up to sell the team, it might be gone also.
And then to Minnesota.
That was one.
Yeah.
And then Senator Cole came out of the phone booth with his Superman suit on.
I'd like to see that.
Give him that often, by the way. I do. And he laughs at me and waves me off. He did. And I was at that press conference. And he was Superman to me. And he kept that team here. With the second time around, Michael Jordan wanted to buy this team, and Herb just basically blew him off. And he would have moved it. I wasn't as concerned the second time around because I knew Herb was not going to let this team leave. One, he's loyal to Wisconsin. His family name, who he is, senator or not, all of that, he was not going to let it go under his watch. It wasn't going to happen. Will it happen someday down the road? I don't know. When he can't put his shadow in it anymore, but he picked people that would keep it here. So I was less concerned as I was the first time before he stepped up. But I immediately thought about couple things. One, well, if the Bucks leave, that's a huge impact to the MAC Fund because we still get high visibility. We get the game. We get everything. Not everything. We get many things through the Bucks. I was concerned about that. And personally, if the Bucks had left either one of those times, I would have felt like a jilted lover. I would have felt like, whoa, I'm here because of the Milwaukee Bucks, and it's family, and they left. They left me. That I would have had to have some counseling on that one, I think, because that would have been a hard one. We love it here, but got to have my Bucks here also.
Because you're a fan as much as anything.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a fan at a different level because of my...
That's fair.
You know, I mean, in terms of understanding the game and all that. But I am. And actually, that's what people have come up to me as far as on the air at times, the time I broke my headset. I mean, I get people come up and talk about that now because they liked that I've reacted as a fan. I'm a color analyst. Play-by-play guys, they try to stay in the middle. I'm a color analyst for the Milwaukee Bucks. So when they're playing badly, I would get upset and point that out. So I'm a fan as a color analyst also because I want us to win.
I think that's pretty clear to anyone who's ever heard you do it.
Yeah, I think so too.
The new arena, I've been through it. It's not nearly as done as the training center.
No.
Is. I mean, it looks as impressive as a 50% built arena can be, but it's amazing to think of where the NBA was when you began your playing career as to the cathedrals that they play in nowadays. I mean, could you have ever imagined that?
No. If the only person I would have believed back when I was playing and I came in 65, 66, that would have said to me, okay, in 50 years, here's what the NBA is going to be. I only would have believed Jesus.
Okay.
If God came down and said, this is what it's going to be, who else are you going to believe that
right.
that could have happened when we were making $8 a day?
You might
meal
look at him like, eh.
No, I mean, yeah, even then, right? I mean, $8 a day meal money, no money, washing your own uniforms, traveling in coach commercial all over. Really? I mean, you couldn't possibly imagine this. People have even asked me that with the MAC fund. Could you have imagined what the MAC funds become and the dollars you've raised back then? And I'm going, there is no way I could imagine that. It's been an incredible growth factor in the NBA as to what has happened. It's still changing rapidly. That's remarkable with this new television contract and now the money you're seeing paid out. We're all, I think, mind-boggled, and you go see these buildings, you'll say the same.
Who's the best player you ever saw?
Doug, honestly, that's impossible to answer. It really is. I'm not sliding the question. You got to consider eras, time frames, like, you know, I've just talked about the changes today, and how good would Russell Chamberlain, Oscar West, Baylor, those guys been today with everything versus LeBron and Bird and you know, you can't say. I couldn't name it. I mean, if I started naming the top 10 to 20 guys, I'd name a lot I've just named. That I can do. I can name who I think the greatest defensive player was, the most powerful player, the most talented offensive center ever was Kareem, and you know the most powerful was Wilt and Shaq, but Shaq wasn't in their class as a basketball player. Russell was the greatest defensive player ever. Oscar was the most perfect player I ever saw, perfect in everything he did, perfect. Greatest athlete might have been Jordan. I think the greatest player that's ever played that got the most out of being slow, couldn't jump, was Bird. Great. You know, the greatest leader on the court I ever saw was Magic. You know, I can do that, but it's hard to just name. But I'll tell you a couple of players that I love to watch, and I played against one of them. I love to watch Rick Barry. Just the way he played and Bird. And not because they're white guys. That isn't it. It's the way that they played. They were fun to watch. And I love to watch Magic because of the way he would lead and do it on the court. And playing with Oscar and Kareem, are you kidding me? I got to play 5 years with two of the greatest players of all time and see it up close in practice. They were professional. They came and played. They weren't moaners and groaners. What a blessing for me.
When all is said and done, when people mention the name John McLaughlin, what do you hope they think of?
Well, I hope they think he was a good man, a faithful man to God, to Jesus, a community man that made life better for his community through what I did, not just the MAC fund, but other things. And, you know, he was a pretty good ball player, but that led to all the other things. That's all. That was a conduit. It was an important part of my life. It still is. You know, I started playing when I was sixth grade. Now I'm 74 years old, and it's still a major. But I think being a faithful, good man, you know, father, husband, things like that, things that everybody goes, oh, yeah, here it comes again. But those are truth.
There's a lot of layers. Athlete, philanthropist, businessman, family man. John McLaughlin, thank you so much for the time.
Pleasure.
perhaps a dated reference or two in there, but for my money, that conversation holds up as much as any conversation I've ever had. An uninterrupted hour with the great John McLaughlin, Mr. Buck himself. Thanks for listening. That'll do it for this edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. Keep subscribing and rating us, hopefully 5 stars. And while you're at it, give us a follow on the socials, on Twitter and Instagram. It is at Doug Russell Pod. On Facebook, search for the Doug Russell Podcast. We're back on Friday with a new show. Of course, no Packers or Badgers football to preview. The Packers are on their bye week. The Badgers haven't begun their season yet. But Brewers GM David Stearns held a season-ending news conference earlier this week. We'll dive into that and more right here on the Doug Russell Podcast. Have a great day. We'll see you on Friday.